Hello, everybody. We should now be live. Hello, all the little people there in my computer. And welcome to our increasingly irregular stream. There's reasons for that, we promise. You'll find that out in due course. Those of you who are members, check the community posts. You'll already know why. But apart from that, there will be a... Just let's say watch this space on July 1st is the first thing I will say. But also, I am not joined by my usual co-host, Evelyn, today. She actually has a league snooker match, apparently against the best player in the league. So she's currently probably getting roundly defeated at snooker, but them's the breaks with one of the better players. I'm joined by Reaction Reading Law. Say hello.
Hello. Hello, chat. Hello, everyone who's watching. Hello, dear viewer. And hello, Scrump.
Hello. As usual, if you want to support us, we are still fully monetized somehow. The best way to do so is in Ko-Fi. That should be the pinned chat message in the chat. Ko-Fi.com/... Well, we know what it is. It's not Ko-Fi.com, but the Ko-Fi I've just linked. It's Ko-Dot... Yeah. Anyway, it's Ko-Dash-Fi. I always say that wrong. I remember the old days of the internet where you had to say your website's right. Oh god, that's a very long time ago, and it dates me terribly. For our usual viewers, the weather has been all over the place. It's been very hot. It's been very rainy, very windy. We've run the gamut, really. Today it's just kind of humid and kind of cloudy. So, shrug weather today, I would say, for those of you who tune in for the weather report. Yeah, tune in, don't tune out. No wait. So
my.
What were you going to say there? Sorry, save me here.
My weather's been really sunny and has been for the last few weeks. I think I've had like one day of rain.
Hmm. Lovely.
And there's been lots of hip hop people out as well.
Oh no, hip hop UKians.
Yeah,
UK. Urban UKians. The urban UK population. Extremely urban.
It's, yes.
God. Jogging towards your neighborhood.
But today, no, they rollerblade, actually.
Rollerblades? Wow, that is retro. Yeah. They're bringing rollerblades back?
Yes.
Oh, man, you might have got some of the dorky ones.
Yeah, all the parks in and around me in London, it's ridiculous. So I was at Victoria Park the other day, and the amount of rollerbladers, you would not believe.
Oh, no. It really is 2004 again. People are rollerblading. How could this happen to me? I don't trust people who rollerblade. Oh god, there's an alarm going off. Give me a second.
No, that's at mine, that is.
That's very annoying.
Yeah, I'll go and see what's going on.
Anyway. That's one of my elderly neighbors who always leaves their alarm on. I see. It's one of those things that happens every time. Well, not every time, but sometimes. There we go. Thank Christ. Getting. It's not my boomer tech. It's someone else's boomer tech. Oh, the rollerblade thing has thrown me a curveball there, though. That must be the rollerblade alarm.
I'm sorry, I'll keep my mouth shut unless I'm being spoken to from now on.
No, it's fine. I just have traumatic flashbacks of rollerblading from like the mid-2000s. The halcyon days of 2004. 2004/2005.
Yes. I was a toddler then.
I'm aware. I was only about 14, 15, so.
I see. So you were rollerblading then?
I was not rollerblading. I did not rollerblade.
I see.
I didn't skateboard either. I walked. I had to walk everywhere. Or I got the bus. About it. I never went for different modes of transport. I used to cycle for a little bit, but the roads in the UK, even in the 90s, were not particularly good for cycling. You can cycle around some of the back streets during the day in the summer if you're a kid, but that's about it. Don't go near the main road. It's just kind of always been like that in Britain. Not really a cycling nation, which is why I can't stand people dressed in lycra. We're not here to talk about cycling. We're here to talk about lawfare. And you've got a book out.
Yes, I do. It's been a long time coming.
It has. But it is Oot and a Boot. It is, of course, well, it's currently available from Imperium Press, who have published it. I will get
Yes.
page up here as we get to the lower third. I've got the little gavel. It seems the gavel there seems to be announcing New Britain. New Britain, I can't talk today. But the subject of lawfare is something that's intrigued me for a long time anyway. And I know it's something that I don't know if this is. Am I remembering this correctly, or was this book cooked up initially at one of our Nomos events, or at least kind of pitched?
It was no. I
All right.
remember I was inspired to write the book by Ewan Woese when you did that stream
Ah, of
mentioning
course,
about lawyers.
yes.
So that was my inspiration for the book. But I'd been writing articles for a while at that point on topics of lawfare. So
Oh, yes.
I decided, with the encouragement of like a friend of mine, like Alexander Adams, and did I discuss it with you two as well?
I think you did actually, yes.
Yeah. And you guys to actually put it into a book and pitch it. So that's what I've done. And I did that some years ago. But yeah, the book's been, or the release, the first draft was finished nearly 2 years ago now. But because I'm essentially an internet nobody, it took a while for it to find its place in the schedule.
That sometimes happens.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
To be fair, I'm quite amazed that the thing has got made at all, and it does look very good. Full disclosure, I haven't read this yet. This is more of a kind of announcement, and also we can just talk about the subject of lawfare in general since we've got the author here.
Okay.
I will be putting out a. I read the first chapter you sent me there, that we'll be getting on screen at
Yeah.
some point. I know there's some bits you might want to go through there, but I will be doing a full review of this. I tend to read books quite slowly, not because I'm a slow reader, but because I'm quite a fast reader, but I don't tend to absorb it all sometimes. But I like to read
Yeah.
books quite slowly and at leisure so I can make little mental notes on them. So I'll be doing probably a full review of this at some point, because I've not really done that for a book, and I'd quite like to, especially kind of a book from someone like you that I can have, a back and forth with if I have questions about it as well.
Yeah.
It helps to have a bit more of an informed. I know a lot of people don't like people being cozy with people they do reviews for on things, but obviously we're friends and you've been in our channel. So I think it's
Yeah.
also just a good exercise to outwardly and nakedly promote kind of what I would consider media from our people and from the very small section of UK politics that doesn't serve, let's say, containment interests, especially on the right, because good Lord, there's precious little of it.
Yes. Well, I don't mind you criticizing what I say in the book publicly, provided you're not super rude about it, because
Oh, I'd
to be
more have
honest,
questions. I don't presume to know enough about the law to criticize it without asking you or someone else first.
yeah,
I
fair
th
enough.
that's how generally I approach subjects that aren't my wheelhouse. If something comes across me as strange, I find generally if it's not your area, I'm not deferent to experts. I might go out and research if I think people's answer is unsatisfactory. But it's always best if it's not your field to ask if you're missing something. Because generally, if you get on with someone opinion-wise, and it seems like they've said something completely insane, a lot of the time you might be misinterpreting what's being said, or it might not be being said literally.
Yes.
I find it's very a much better approach to take. But yeah, okay, you go on that.
Oh no, I'm just saying that that's a solid approach and something I would agree with, because since I sort of started my channel, I have got into arguments with people who, being charitable, are quite enthusiastic and wedded to certain ideas, but they're not flexible on those ideas from a pragmatic point of view. So I often have arguments with Kooksphere women about the way the law works and issues of natural law. So I remember, like, quite a lot of people I know and hang out with in the Kooksphere can't get their head around the idea that natural law, as came up with by the likes of Aquinas and Dicey, doesn't exist anymore, because they were drawing from a society that was extremely Christian, extremely ethnically homogenous. So the assumptions of just law, natural law, within the context of the way that the law is in rules that are enforced by violence,
Yes.
work is quite difficult for those people to understand and me to explain to them, because they're wedded to ideas that they would like to be reflected in reality that aren't.
They don't understand the first principles of where law comes from and how it interacts with power, especially, is, that's the reason.
And they don't want to.
Yeah, they really don't want
because, I've noticed this, and this is something that I've noticed like with friends and family who I can convince on certain issues, but it really upsets them. For example, this exists in the pro-life community as well, which I'm somewhat part of. You've got to be very careful convincing someone that abortion is wrong or abortion is murder if they've had an abortion, because once you convince them, you will mess them up well and truly, and they'll probably need some quite serious grief counselling.
Yes, that is true.
And that goes on for our ideas of elite theory and other things that we talk about, such as race realism, on a less dramatic scale with people.
I get what you mean, yes, but you can't, you've got to be very careful what you tell people, because sometimes they'll also take the information and extrapolate things from other sources that may not necessarily be compatible with it as well. So yeah. you can also just end up confusing people. I've had discussion and debate with a few people because, well, it's sometimes just not worth engaging with certain people sometimes. But if you're just going to confuse people, if you're just going to get them kind of, 60% of the way there so they just feel a bit miserable about things, that's not always the nicest thing to do. I've gone back and forth about whether we should, quote-unquote, red pill the normies and things like that. But no, I don't really think in many cases we should.
I think it's cruel, actually, to be honest, for a lot of people. Unless they actively want to, I think it's quite cruel to red pill the normies.
Especially if they have nowhere to go with it. But so this is, what audience would you say this book is aimed for then? Is it aimed at a general audience, or is it aimed at people who know something already about the law?
No, it's aimed at a general audience. This is one of the discussions I had early on with the Imperium Press guys, is it needs to be accessible to Joe Schmo off the street.
Yes.
And that's something I've tried to do. And to be honest, my publishers, Imperium, were very helpful in helping me draft it in such a way that it can be read and understood by the layperson. Because my writing style, if for those of you who subscribe to my Substack, I'm quite academic in the way I write.
It is slightly technical in terms of... I understand some of it because I've encountered a lot of legal jargon, just mostly through years and years of trying to read policy documents and courts summaries and judgments, especially when that pertains to the the supposed living canon of English and British law. Some of that can be quite hard to disentangle. But even then, I do... Law is not really my area, and I do find myself sometimes stretched by it because it's not something I really have formal expertise in, and it is so complicated, especially now in the UK, that, again, not everyone, but basically everyone who's interested in practical ideas was calling for this book to exist, basically. I know I definitely was. Basically well done writing it in response to the call, because you actually had to go out and write it and then, wait for it to go through the edit queue and all that stuff. So, first of all... I know I've not read it. The first chapter you gave me was good. And I know your opinions of the law are quite good from your Substack. By the way, you can get Reaction Reading Law on Substack. A quick little shill there. He's also on Twitter. And the links for that are down below. I forgot to say that at the beginning. But this is a book I've heard that from a lot of people should exist, especially from more of our point of view. I know it has to be written again for quite a general audience, but did you write this with, say, people who were taking on the larger entities of the regime in mind?
Yes, I did. It's written from a sensible centrist point of view, so our point of view. That's what I wrote it for. Basically trying to help people who either work in policy or strategy or activists themselves stop making stupid mistakes so that they can actually get somewhere. Because one of the things that I've basically been banging on about since I met a lot of you guys years ago was that, especially people with big audiences, whenever they start complaining about an issue, it was more prominent during the whole woke period, which is now basically gone. But whenever you're complaining about an issue, you need to not just complain about it on Twitter, but you need to complain about it in specific detail to the right people. For example, I'll use a cringe woke example, which I think I use in the book, I don't know off the top of my head. Official complaints instead of Twitter complaints, for example.
Yes.
Complaining about ex woke police force having the trans flag is mostly a waste of time, especially if you're just doing it on Twitter. Whereas if you write an official complaint to the police regulator or the official complaints person at the police force and make sure it's an official complaint and complain about, okay, why are you showing walking parading with a trans flag? Because from my understanding of the police's obligations and charter, that's not allowed because they're endorsing a political cause. And if you
Yes.
really want to be a smart sausage, you can actually have a bit of a look as to what the local police force's arrangements are with certain lobbyist groups and actually make complaints. Because if it's one or two of you might get nowhere. But if you're a large outlet like Lotus Eaters and you're covering it as a story, a police force that's displaying the trans flag, it wouldn't be that hard to leave a link in the description as to if you're in that area, this is who you complain to. Be polite, because
Yes.
it doesn't work all the time, but it works enough of the time for it to be somewhat productive. Because by law, depending on your the official complaints procedure you use, they have to be reviewed in a certain number of days or a certain number of weeks, and they have to be reviewed. And there's a set process for escalating that complaint to another person. And what I found happens when I've done this is most people who deal with things like complaints handling are quite like normies, and if they get something complained about enough of a time, they spend enough time talking about it, they'll normally just drop it.
Yes,
And this is why.
it is really as well. A lot of the people that you engage with when you engage, especially with civil law and complaints processes, especially with government departments and the public sector, you will find that if you get enough people to complain enough, they just respond through laziness and they take the line of least resistance.
Yes. I mean, I'm of an age where, because of where I grew up, I was a child when they started bringing ridiculous health and safety stuff. And the reason for that, where I grew up, was because you'd get one mum who would complain because they wrapped their child in cotton wool about, oh no, you can't light fires because you might get burnt. Oh no, you can't do knife skills at Scouts because you might end up stabbing someone or becoming a serial killer. Crap like that. But because by law, those complaints had to be discussed. It often meant that out of laziness, those activities that are very wholesome and important for young children to learn how to do would just get dropped. And it's the same here with politics. If you waste enough of someone's time, you'll often get them to drop it out of laziness. So I couldn't agree more with your point there.
Well, the thing, and I know the other thing I've noticed as well, just from my experience of it as an outsider, and obviously I do read your Substack as well, is that a lot of people just don't have a good starting point for how they would engage in these things. It's very
Oh no.
difficult to get the first step of, right, how do I, one, not get taken for a ride by some sort of predatory ambulance chasing lawyer or a political lawyer that's gonna, completely destroy your image at some point, as some people have been taken for a ride for. I'm thinking of people like Milo who got a lot of handlers around him as well. Like, how do you start to get the knowledge of what bad and good legal advice even is? That's the biggest thing I found, is that sometimes people will think that they're going to engage in lawfare. They'll talk to somebody who thinks that they're an expert in it, and they just get a whole bunch of money extracted out of them because they're asking for the wrong things.
Yeah, that certainly is a problem because without getting into any details, a lot of the problems that I've seen with people not being able to do anything legally is they don't understand what they want. For example, if you were hypothetically thinking about suing an organization for stealing your intellectual property, for example. The problem with that is intellectual property is similar to defamation law in terms of any claim for defamation or intellectual property and some other areas of law, like commercial construction technology law, it has to go straight to the High Court, which makes things very expensive very quickly. There is also a pre-action procedure that is unique to those areas of law.
Yes.
So you basically need to know. It depends, because if you're suing someone for defamation, I would say don't unless you have money to burn or it's someone else who's paying for it who has money to burn. Because even if you win a defamation case, you're going to be at least 100 grand in the hole.
You don't get
And
legal fees from either side with defamation cases.
no. So you don't get any legal aid. And the problem with the defamation is it's really expensive. And even if you win against an organization or an individual, they might not have money to pay you. They might go bankrupt or whatever.
Yes.
So I would generally say that taking people to court or trying to force issues through the court is generally a waste of time in the UK because of how expensive it is. And if it's something that isn't a private lawyer issue, like someone defaming you, then if it's a public law area of law, the UK is quite different from the US in that I know some Americans will argue that in fact the Supreme Court or doesn't have the power to legislate from the bench or strike out legislation. I'll put that by the by for now because the observable reality is that the Supreme Court in the US has exercised the power to repeal laws or give assigned certain rights that aren't directly within the Constitution, causing dramatic social change. That isn't anywhere near the case with the UK. So, if you were to appeal to a public law court, what would be limited, what it's limited to is making advisory decisions against the government, which, depending on the context, might be legally binding. Or alternatively, if you're suing someone like Ofcom, you might get a procedural win that's on a proportionality basis that is, in this particular case, X organization or X government department or X quangor acted unlawfully.
Yes. You could also say if you were going against an NGO, you could make an appeal to the people who fund them. Well, if
Yes.
they are someone who receives public money, you could make a complaint to the public body that they receive money from.
Yes, that is a better use of your time than strategic lawsuits from a UK context because litigation, both public law litigation and private law litigation, such as defamation, is just too expensive. So there are cheaper ways of doing public law litigation, but that normally starts with the complaints process,
Yes.
and that's administrative tribunals, which, for those of you who don't know, a tribunal is, as the word suggests, three people. So you have normally a legal expert who will be a judge and other experts that are related to the particular type of tribunal. So for an administrative tribunal, you'll probably have an administrative law expert, whether that's a barrister, whether that's a judge, and then you'll have some administrative experts. And the point of an administrative tribunal is it's a cheaper way to get to judicial review and similar things. So, an administrative tribunal is, I discussed this in the book, but basically, a tribunal, unlike court, is less formal. It's probably better to seek legal advice before going to a tribunal. However, unlike the court, it's a lot more accessible in terms of the formality of the procedure. So, a lay person could get on with the tribunal and get on with it without having no idea what they're doing. And with administrative tribunals, you escalate to various appeals processes, and then eventually you end up with a form of judicial review. But that's something that isn't particularly well known.
Well, we've got a little
Right.
section of your book here. I was going to go down quickly to the bit where it talks about, you do talk about strategic lawsuits here and political lawfare in general, but
Yeah.
I don't think. Differences in tactics in the way lawfare works. This is what you're talking about here, though, in that there are, in the UK, you're much better, as you said, appealing to statutory bodies which cover a lot more of public and private life than they do in the US, where that seems to be officiated by the civil courts in some cases. It seems that things like, there are voluntary bodies, but there's no body like Ofcom in the US. And so a lot of things are settled via the civil courts there, which is, I'm glad you mentioned this. This is one of the things that caught my eye when I was reading it, because that is a huge mistake. I think this is the biggest mistake I see people, like you said, in the UK engaging in when they engage in law. But even from my kind of layman perspective, I understand that UK law is not US law, partly through, reading people like you and seeking other legal, good legal opinions. But a lot of people don't. A lot of people think the law is what they see in the movies. They have like horrible fiction brain with how law works, and they don't understand that law is entirely procedural. It doesn't matter really if you are quote unquote right or not. That is a judgment call. What it matters is really is that you understand the procedure to prove you may or may not be right. And people, I think, as a starting point, they don't understand that they are 99% ticking boxes and both sides are 99% doing the same thing. And so it's about doing the normal things right. And I think that's, again, that's something that I don't know if you communicate it more as the book goes on, but when we talk about differences in tactics here, I think what you're trying to get at is that like, a lot of people just need to understand that there is effective and ineffective lawfare, and the first hurdle is knowing what the difference between those two is.
The book is a US and UK comparison. So the reason I've done that is the British legal system and the American legal system, despite that it's often and described as very like one another or very like each other, I disagree with that in terms of the raw function and the way they function and the powers the British legal system has. Okay, it is true to say that the British legal system did inspire the American judicial system. However, the powers that the American judiciary has is so different from that of the UK that you need to deal with them separately. And my reason, the secondary reason for choosing to do a UK and US comparison is that the British legal system is one extreme. And the American legal system is the other extreme. And what I mean by that is the powers of the judiciary to repeal legislation or order that the government does things or d create rights where there previously wasn't rights in terms of practice. So most European countries have some weird mix of the two. But most European countries have constitutional courts that can strike out legislation and order the government to do things. So I'll use the example of the Netherlands. So the Netherlands, and the reason why Europe's populist parties probably aren't going to get anywhere is because they have put no attention to the courts. And the way that those countries' constitutions work often is that the courts can just strike out legislation. And furthermore, they can also force international agreements to be adhered to by the government as well. So the Netherlands has direct effect of international treaties, which my understanding of the way that works is any treaty that is signed by the government of the Netherlands is automatically or automatically has direct effect on the law of the Netherlands without it being ratified. Whereas in the UK and the US, for an international treaty to be legally binding in the UK, it has to be ratified by Parliament or Congress.
Yes.
I'm aware that I've just used quite a bit of legal jargon. Do I need to explain some of those terms, or is everyone okay?
Think most people would understand that. It also helps explain why the European Court of Human Rights, especially, and the European courts in general, were so poor in terms of compatibility with the UK, because we were not used to the legal system overruling politics. And the legal system overruling law. You're right, the English law tradition is that really the law is the law, and laws should be done right so the judges don't have to do too much work. I know one of the things that you've talked about, that actually, your piece here about Don't Blame the Judge. This is back from back in May. But you're very right in that the lawfare in terms of legislating from the bench in the UK is not really as possible as it is in the US, because they don't have the power to say that a certain law is unconstitutional. The judges don't really have the power to say that Parliament is wrong. They can say that it broke its own rules, but they can't say that it's, you know, they may have to make it adhere to its own rules. But ultimately, they can only adjudicate if Parliament is right by Parliament's own standards. They can't say that Parliament's standards for being right are wrong. And that is a very, as you said, a very big distinction there.
Yeah, certainly, because the topic of does Parliament have sovereignty, for the most part, is an open and closed issue. There are some Supreme Court justices in the UK who've had that conversation somewhat recently, which I've discussed in my Substack, but really there's nothing to the argument. It's purely theoretical and based on there not being a head-on collision between Parliament and the Supreme Court, because essentially, the point that's made in that argument is, oh, well, if the Supreme Court told Parliament that they were acting unlawfully, Parliament would act lawfully. But as an argument, it doesn't really go anywhere, because the Supreme Court used to be the law lords, and it was a body that was made up by Tony Blair, which, in my opinion, was part of an Americanization of British politics, because of our royal roots in the UK, lots of institutions were somewhat blended together, because Parliament did its own job, but most of the executive in the UK has its origins in the Crown. Yes. So what Tony Blair did, and Lloyd George as well, about 100 years ago now, was they started to break it up and take it all out of the hands of the Crown.
Well, what it was the House of Lords was a proper lower house. It was a proper second chamber where, you know, the judiciary sat and were able to help ratify the laws, and help look over the laws.
Yeah.
So there wouldn't be friction between the judiciary and the executive and, you know, the lawmakers, because the judiciary were involved in the secondary part of lawmaking. It's actually a very good system.
Yes.
And people talk about, you know, the American application of separation of powers is completely arbitrary. Britain had completely unseparated powers because it was all still technically under the crown, and got on marvelously throughout its entire history. So you're right in that a lot of these are the legal positive aspect, as you mentioned. And I was going to try and work this in, but you mentioning Tony Blair and that change. A lot of people have started to buy into this idea because we had the ridiculous thing of the Boris Johnson traitors parliament, you know, should he have prorogued, should he not have prorogued thing, and the farce of the British Supreme Court, and also the, you know, the government effectively suing itself to make it commit climate suicide. There's a lot of performative acts of kind of legislating from the bench that would lead normal people to believe that they can appeal to the courts in a way that would allow English law to be overturned. But that simply isn't true. It's this bizarre situation where you have the government stepping on its own head, basically, or pretending to step on its own throat. You know, it's the arm in the boot picture, because really, as people have explained tirelessly, really on stupid debates and GB News that don't really matter, Parliament is Parliament, and Parliament can just pass a law saying you smell bad and not to listen to you. And that's how Parliament works, because Parliament could really just disband the UK Supreme Court with a simple majority, because it is simply a body that was created with a simple majority. So it is what it is. So again, it does seem that the Americanization aspect and the confusion between America and Britain is, in terms of political kind of lawfare and civil lawfare and how to conduct it, and how, you know, the role of judges and the role of certain cases, a lot of people don't have a good understanding in the UK of either side of that, it seems.
No. I mean, it's a really big waste of money that I see in even people who should know better. So because I'm more involved in the London political scene, I'll talk to people who write checks and fund organisations for campaign groups, And they have no idea how the British political system works, and it's quite concerning. So, without mentioning any names, there are people that I speak to who seem to think that it's a good idea to try and sue Ofcom and or sue the government over Ofcom to try and get the online harms bill repealed. And you talk to these people and you think, right, okay, you need to do a proper civics course, because the fact that you're involved in political campaigning and you don't know how the political system works means that you're going to get nowhere.
Yes. And I think that's, again, I will give my full thoughts and I've read the full book, but I think, as you're going to hear, people's conception of law is very important, because I know you're someone who's quite keen on aspects of natural law. British, legal tradition is very based on the ideas of natural law, on not stepping too much on common law and decisions of local magistrates. That a lot of that was retained right into the 20th century. And people's conception of the law is very important. How I don't know, how do you push for a natural law perspective in this book, or would you are you just
No,
trying to
not at all.
describe reality as it is, would you say?
I'm trying to describe reality as it is and suggest a way forward, because as a Catholic, there are certain views of natural law that I would suppose and would like to be discussed and used in the making and interpretation of statutory and common law. But the problem with that is that only works in the British ethno-state where everyone's Catholic, which we don't live in.
Well, it used to be the agreement that there was somewhat of a standard that we were at least all British and all in some way Christian, or at least in some way, moral and civilized. That was more where that came from. And really, the idea of natural law isn't a canonical thing. It isn't a denominational thing. It is something really that I talk about it in the speech that I gave to the first Witan in 2021. About deprogramming British democracy. There's this very clear idea from British people about what the law is, what justice is, and that concept has worked and been maintained for so long because it wasn't written down on a piece of paper. It was instilled in everybody who lived in Britain that they had this extremely strong sense of what should happen. And when that was violated, there was outrage. People would be in outrage over what we could consider extremely small things, but it shows you that living idea of what the law is in people's heads was much more powerful than the law written down.
Oh, yeah. Because fundamentally, a system only works if the people within that system work. So you can't. The system isn't enough to protect itself. The system only works with people who designed that system and want that system to continue, because otherwise it will just break down.
So, what would you say? I know I've been over this a couple, but what would you say are the biggest misconception people have about conducting lawfare? Is it the frivolous American style lawsuit, or is there something kind of structurally deeper there? You think in the flaws of how people conduct law?
So I would say certainly is probably the frivolous American style lawsuit, purely and simply because I've seen organizations that in some cases are quite well funded, so you would think would be able to afford competent legal advice, spend millions on a legal case, sometimes win, and effectively get nowhere. So I'm talking about things like, I know an organisation that was looking into taking Britain to court, to the European Court of Human Rights, over certain pieces of legislation it was going to enact. And I was talking to this person at a party about what their plans were, because they just told me and they're seeking legal advice and so on and so forth. And I was like, the problem you've got is organisations like the European Court of Human Rights aren't actually as powerful in Britain as you think they are, because
No.
of how the British constitutional setup works. This is discussed and explained in the book, but essentially, because we have parliamentary sovereignty in the UK, the judgments, especially against the UK government by organisations like the European Court of Human Rights, can and have been ignored on a fairly regular basis. So the example that I believe I mentioned in the book is the prisoners voting, the European Court of Human Rights versus, it's not in the first chapter, versus the UK. And essentially what that was that was in around the 2010 era, David Cameron, and prisoners brought a claim against the UK for violation of their human rights because they said that it was a human right to vote. The court agreed with them, and then Parliament tried to, or a bill was tabled in Parliament, and it got rejected and nothing happened. So the European Court of Human Rights or any other international court is not going to be able to compel the British government Parliament into enacting law that it doesn't want to enact.
No.
So that's probably the biggest mistake. Whereas the Supreme Court in the US and in other countries have been able to do that thus far. So that's probably the biggest misunderstanding I see about lawfare. And the second thing is don't call it lawfare.
Yes, I was going to get that. Yes, call it call it justice.
Yes.
Call it the seeking of justice. Call it the setting right of wrongs.
Yes.
Of course, when you're conducting lawfare, it's okay. The whole point of lawfare is it's not only okay when we do it, it's not lawfare when we do it. Lawfare
Yes.
is a, you're using the words, as a way to hook people in, I get it, but the thing is, genuinely, it's true though, in that most of what is being done here, and most of what is done with the legal system in Britain, is to reinforce rather than hold to account those already in power.
Yes.
It is the reverse of what we usually think. And so it is
Yes.
really for the people who do see things counter, it is contingent on them really to defend themselves in these ways.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think a lot of people would be quite squeamish about the idea of lawfare in the same way people are quite squeamish about the term propaganda. But really what you're
Yeah.
saying is that you understand that what you're doing is political and that doesn't preclude it from being right.
Certainly not, certainly not. Like, I would love for the people I know in the pro-life movement who may use strategic lawsuits, I would love for them to be successful. Like, I would love for that to work because it means less dead babies. So I do use a sort of pro-life example in the UK, in the book actually. And one of the examples is the pro-life movement have complained for ages about women who get abortions not actually being seen to properly and just being rushed in and then ending up with PTSD and other quite serious mental conditions. But I suggest this in the book. If that is true, you need to not even sue because suing lots of people is expensive. I certainly think that there is a place for personal injury cases of that kind. But medical professionals are regulated and they're regulated quite strictly. If that does happen, and my pro-life friends are very correct in that happening, I don't know, I haven't spoken to anyone who that's happened to. I've only heard second and third hand accounts. Complain about the doctors and nurses involved personally to their regulator because they can probably get struck off. And even if it doesn't happen all the time, and they're not struck off. The fact that there will be some people struck off for that, and some people will be under investigation for that, will mean that the sort of completely on-demand abortions that are available now are done less often because the medical professionals taking part in that will soon get the message that actually, if we do rush someone through into getting an abortion who is perhaps vulnerable or whatever, we might lose our jobs or worse, get struck off
Yeah, it's the
and be
threat.
barred from
It's
practicing.
the chilling effect that you actually do want.
Yes.
It's the at least threat of action there. And a good example as well, you mentioned the abortion thing, is that the I know a lot of people tried to sue the government or came up with lawsuits against the government for the exclusion zones around abortion clinics. But as you
Yes.
said, really the approach in the UK should be to complain to the police regulators to say that the
Yeah.
imposed orders are disproportionate and unfair, and
Yeah.
you have to take more of a civil rights angle with it. Speaking of, you mentioned here at the end of your introduction critical legal theory and some of the stuff from the left, the Frankfurt School. What do you think are the biggest lessons in terms of lawfare that we can learn from the left?
Right, so I finished writing this book when AA did his Witten speech and he brought out populist delusion. So that's when I finished the first draft. And my conclusion to the book essentially is you need to reject conservative ideas of law and not leveraging the law to get what you want. You need to be able to understand, as someone on the right, for whatever the right exists or for however long that you accept that term, as a sensible individual, you need to accept that you should be using the law as a tool to get what you want.
Yes.
If you don't, someone else is going to. I do believe that judicial independence is a good thing. However, judicial independence only works for so long as all or most of the parties involved are in favour and enact judicial independence through their own actions.
Yes. I know it sounds like a tautology, but judicial independence only makes sense if the judiciary are actually independent and capable of being
Yes.
so. Judicial independence is not about the independence for legislating from the bench, for example. It's not about the independence for judiciary discretion. The idea of judiciary independence in the UK really is to make sure that they are able to enforce things and apply things uniformly without interference. It's not to allow them to turn the law to their whims. And again, I think that's a bit of an Americanization from the judge point of view, and that certain judges seem to believe it is their job to make proclamations from the bench.
Well, I would say to some extent that there is a place for judicial interpretation, and a lot of that in the UK will be on the public interest. This is discussed in the book, so I won't go into too much detail. But essentially, my point is, as soon as you start talking about the public interest, that becomes a political decision for that judge. And right-wing judges should have no issue whatsoever going, actually, whatever right-wing person or argument that is being made, whether it's in defense of free speech, they should just apply the public interest test, in my opinion, in a way that is in line with their personal philosophy and not be too hung up on principles of judicial independence in the sense that the judiciary isn't political. For example, if you, as a judge, need to make a decision that protects one of our people from whether it's they're being sued or prosecuted for something, and they've got a public interest defence, you should just apply it in their favour.
There is discretion, and there is the idea that, as a judge, all those who are judges who are ideologically opposed to you will always maximize their position. If you are
Oh, yeah.
involved in a, that's where there does need to be some degree of hegemony within the judiciary, especially because there doesn't need to
Yeah.
be this tit for tat war in the law courts about
Yeah.
political activism. The British judiciary were able to maintain such a level of respect because they stayed very much out of politics. It's ironic that when they had more to do with politics, they had less to do with politics, it seems. When they
Yes.
were able to express it behind closed doors properly, when they were able to be more involved in the process itself, they felt less inclined to try and throw their weight about in public. And quite frankly, judges have begun in quite a US sense to make asses of themselves. And that's a
Yes.
very, very bad thing for the British legal system because it is just based on faith.
Yeah, so one of the things that I get into in the book is part of the reason why the British judiciary is considerably more independent, even now, than many other jurisdictions, is the British judiciary doesn't actually have that much power other than in a civil sense to enforce contracts and enforce the law. So it can't start, as I've mentioned earlier in this stream, it can't force the government to do things that it doesn't want to do, and it can't strike out legislation or give, basically make up rights that in practice didn't previously exist. So the British judiciary is very reactive, and its purpose is still very narrow, even though certain political judges, not naming names, might make the claim that they have more power than they do.
It does seem to be almost like a bluff in that regard. And
yeah,
I think that really a lot of people think it works more, it works less that way than it appears to. To have a more positive example then, what do you think is the most useful vector for lawfare in terms of what people can do in the UK, in terms of what they can do like right now?
Start by making official complaints, because that's the easiest thing for people to do. And when I say make official complaints, I mean, if there's something that annoys you in your local area, complain to whoever, that's, and work from there. Another thing is probably be considerably more in touch with local politics and understand, get a basic understanding of how certain local bodies work, because normally you'll save yourself a lot of time by making an official complaint and at least having those type of issues dealt with at the preliminary stage, for example. Because of what I do, I see it all the time where people will just, the first thing they'll go for is legal action. And this will be in something that's completely apolitical, but legal action is very expensive. It's very time consuming. So it might just work to go to write an official complaint to somebody and engage in collaborative and productive conversations as to how you can get what you want, or how you can get the government to stop doing what you don't want them to do. And there is problems with that, in that you don't have too much power to force them to stop doing something. But in the UK context, I would say that's quite true about the courts as well.
Yes.
Especially if there's primary legislation ordering something be done. So one of the things I know a bit about is the Equalities Act. A lot of the cases, this isn't mentioned in the books, I'll talk all day about this if you let me. The Equalities Act has had a lot of high-profile cases where people seem to have won and seem to have got rid of positive action, or that's how it's portrayed in the media. What's actually happened is that there have been judgments made by judges on specific cases, on specific issues, that say, okay, in this particular case, the application of positive action and the public sector equality duty was disproportionate because this, this, and this was done, and there wasn't this safeguard or this procedure followed. So if I remember rightly, there was a case some years ago about with Cheshire Police. And when you read the actual judgment, it was portrayed in the media as it's unlawful to discriminate against straight white men. It's not entirely true. So essentially, the reason that guy won his case was because the police force refused to interview any straight white men. Whereas it was actually, if I remember rightly, said by the judge, if they'd have given an advantage to the other groups and disadvantaged the straight white males within proportionate grounds, that wouldn't have been unlawful. So that's what I like to call a proportionality-based victory, and proportionality-based victories don't really get on anywhere.
No, and that's what a lot of the Free Speech Union have been doing, in that yes. A lot of their purported legal victories, when they bring these legal cases, are proportionality victories. They'll also often go for people who are, I don't know, representatives of other causes. It's very odd that we have these people doing these test cases that go nowhere, that you know, you end up with months and fundraising. It really seems like a great way for people to pay tens of thousands of pounds to have meaningless proportionality agreements about things that make them feel good. But I, again, I'm not the legal expert here, so
So at some point, I'm going to do an update on employment law protections for free speech for our side, because some years ago when I first started writing my articles, it was my understanding from reading the case law on when does the Equality Act protect your right to freely express a genuinely held philosophical view, was actually quite broad in terms of what views they protect, provided that those views were protected or presented in a polite way. That's changed somewhat recently with the case. I forget the name of the case because it's just popped into my head, so I apologize, people. I'll at some point publish a Substack article explaining this. But views of like ethnic nationalism aren't protected in terms of employment free speech law to any stretch of the imagination, because the case I'm thinking of, the employment tribunal said, oh, the false data judgment, which was the one that established that you were entitled to express a sincerely held philosophical or political view as long as it was polite, was didn't apply to ethnic nationalism because its views holding ethnic nationalist viewpoints or English nationalist viewpoints aren't acceptable for or should be restricted by a democratic society or some nonsense like that. So it is a problem that I see when lots of money goes towards defending TERFs or sometimes left-wing people, and very little of it goes to protecting people on the right.
Yes, it's the actual people who would have judgments ruled against them generally who need the lawfare conducted on their behalf, because then you can escalate things and you can really show where the gaps are. But it's again, if you are going to have these large-scale lawsuits that end up with judgments, about how the law should be enforced, or even have something be reviewed in Parliament, it is much easier for the people that I've seen to have a both political and legal side to it. And generally, it seems that the political side of things seems to get things done a lot quicker than the legal side does in the UK.
Yeah, certainly. So I was on Twitter before I came on here, and I was looking at parliamentary petitions. And parliamentary petitions, for those who aren't in the UK or don't know, if you use the official parliamentary website petitions and you get over 100,000 signatures, your petition has to be debated in Parliament. And I've seen a lot of these going around recently. And the problem with them, essentially, is that the person writing the petition or setting up the petition doesn't really have in-depth knowledge as to what they are petitioning against.
Yes.
So there's one that I've just retweeted from someone called Charlie Bentley Aston, who I think I follow, or someone else I follow follows her on Twitter, and I saw it. It was made a couple of days ago, actually. And basically, the petition that she was retweeting was actually, I've forgotten what it's called, but it doesn't really matter. The petition wasn't very specific. Oh, yeah, it was to do with social media censorship and the penalties that
I
rose
think
from
I
the
saw that one
online
too.
harm thing.
Miss Bentley Astor seems to make her way into my feed as well.
Yes, certainly. If that's my fault, I apologize. But
No. It generally gets fed to you. She's part of the wider kind of new culture forum sphere, I would say. Certainly one
I
of those
see.
people who
Okay.
wants to be a knowledge influencer, quotes, and very much the type of person to share a badly worded parliament petition, I will say. Along with
Yes.
a lot of what I would consider gentle UK slop.
Yes. So the reason I have an issue with that petition and other petitions that I've seen that mutual friends of ours have retweeted and signed is that it's not specific. So there's that one. If it had mentioned specific parts of the Online Harms Bill or Online Safety Bill and saying this in particular needs dealing with, the debate in Parliament would be a lot more specific. Instead of talking about vague sort of philosophical arguments on whether prison time is or is not a sufficient punishment for online activities.
Yes.
And another example of this is there was a There was a petition going around that I think Rupert Lowe started or he'd retweeted that was petitioning the government and parliament to stop funding the accommodation of refugees.
I think I saw that one, yes, like, I did.
Yeah.
I did see that one.
That's great. I'm glad that got 100,000 signatures, but you didn't mention any specific legislation. So it's going to get nowhere.
No. And so that would be your second point then, is be specific.
Yes,
make official complaints. Don't create lawsuits. Make official complaints through official channels and try and quote the legislation, or especially what I've looked at is a lot of these organizations have safeguarding principles, governing principles. Yeah. They have 1,000 pages of waffle. If you start quoting their waffle back to them, they have to take it a bit more seriously as well.
Yeah.
I might actually, a good idea as a follow-up to this at some point would be to create, I'd love to do another stream with you on how to make official complaints.
I would happily come on for that.
So I'd love to do like an example one. I'd probably just use like a police force that isn't mine, a council that isn't mine. We'll pick a police force, a council, and a government body out of a hat, and we'll make up some hypothetical things, and we'll go through how to complain, how you would structure that complaint, and some of their own language you can use in those complaints. I think that'd be extremely exponentially useful. We can also show the book a bit more again and be like, hey, if you want more legal stuff, there's a book for this. But I would love to get people kind of a little bit of almost like a legal 101. We've given people a little bit of the like policy paper, white paper 101, a little bit of the inside baseball on that. But I think a good follow-up to this would be actually just a stream about, you know, even just those two, the how to make official complaints and how to be specific, how to understand what pieces of legislation that you might think are, you know, always going to disadvantage you can advantage you. The Equality Act, you know, I know a lot of people want to use the Equality Act. The example of them using that for more gender critical things is the one many people bring up. But really, there's a lot of complaints procedures and fairness tests and a lot of the government's own red tape can be used to wrap them up. And I think that's really the biggest advantage in the UK, is that there is all this process that the government has to do at their own expense. If you're making a legal complaint, it is at your expense. If you're going through the government's own complaint procedures, that happens at their expense.
Yeah. Also, because of what I do, if you've gone through a complaints procedure and been actively pursuing it, especially if you've gone to like ombudsman and stuff, judges will be quite happy to impose quite a lot of your costs if you win. So if you've just taken legal action against the government for whatever reason and you don't try and resolve it first, especially through complaints and stuff, you can be penalised for costs. So for civil complaints in the UK, there's a pre-action procedure which often involves things like mediation, multiple complaints and negotiation with the party. And if you don't do that, what can happen is you can end up getting your costs not returned to you if you win, or worse, having the judge otherwise penalise you in terms of costs. So starting small with official complaints and letters and actually trying to have a productive conversation with people is a far better way of getting somewhere than just going straight for the legal route.
Yes. Again, it is a lot about the process as well and going through the process. Yeah. And that is one of the big things that I've heard and been told and I've dealt with myself in terms of trying to get things sorted, is that if you have to resort to legal action, and if you can show that you have exhausted all your non-legal action avenues, that works greatly in your favor. And it can actually greatly embarrass an organization if you show that their mediation processes don't work. Because demonstrating that their mediation and resolution processes don't work is actually a very powerful way to prove that they are acting unfairly.
Yeah. I mean, especially because if you've exhausted your complaints procedure and they just haven't listened to you and you're asking for X thing, you might be able to make a successful application for a summary judgment. And if you can prove that because you've exhausted their process, and they've handled whatever it is so badly, a judge might just go, oh, such and such body of government or such and such, this person's been trying every turn to resolve the dispute with you, and from the evidence you presented, you don't have a leg to stand on. So I'm just going to make a summary judgment now. And
Here's
that
a
saves the cost massively.
little tidbit. I won't be specific here, but someone I talk to and I'm an acquaintance of, let's say, ended up trying to make a freedom information request of basically MI5. It sounds laughable, but they have to have a freedom of information procedure too. And it turned out that the payment page for trying to submit a freedom information request to MI5 was broken, which was actually a violation of some of their statutory duties. And obviously, the information that was asked for was refused for under official secrets grounds, but there was a minor embarrassment there, and actually a very minor apology there from MI5 to my acquaintance about the fact that they had not followed proper data procedure in having the process for freedom of information requests functional. And the thing is, it's little things like that you can use to demonstrate that an organization does not have good faith mechanisms in place. And you can, a lot of it is mildly inconveniencing and mildly embarrassing people. But if you can do enough to mildly inconvenience and mildly embarrass certain government departments, they do have to start making a response to it. You at the very least will waste their time. And as everyone always asks me to kind of round this out about what the solution is, and lawfare is brought up as a solution by me as well, and a lot of other people. But practically understanding what it is, I think, is very important. I'm not just hawking this book because obviously you're my friend, and I don't want to support you. The reason this book, part of the reason this book exists, is because quite a few people, rightly thought that this is something that we need to grapple with. This is an extremely important part of what we do and how we do it, and understanding the ways to navigate that. And if you take nothing away from this in terms of, advice on how to think about using these things to advantage, like I said, I'll repeat it again, make official complaints and learn how to make official complaints correctly, and learn what processes of the government you can use against them, because like we've hammered into people a little bit, and I quite enjoy that we have, don't think you're going to have a big American style lawsuit. That's kind of the takeaway from the introduction here already, and I would very much advise people, if they are interested in this area, to go and buy the book.
Yes, please buy the book, ideally from Imperium Press, because then I get money, and the great resource for our circles that is Imperium Press can also keep the lights on.
Oh yes, we'll have our own relatively exciting. Some of you know about it, but we'll have our own relatively exciting news on July 1st. We had a donation though. Thank you, Willie McDuff, for the $5. It's such a, it's as much bureaucratic warfare as it is lawfare. That is true. Lawfare is just an umbrella term, and I do like that you're very much bringing in the statutory approach here. I've heard so few people. A lot of people think that the official complaints processes are useless, but they're actually not. That's why all these DEI managers, these mediation managers, that's why they employ all these HR people to deal with all of this. And it does, within their own metrics, have to be dealt with. And if they don't deal with it, it tends to count against them. Is there anything else you have to shill then, or any other kind of burning points you've got before we go then?
Not really. There's my Substack, which we've mentioned,
Yes.
which links in the description. There's the book. There's my Twitter, which is at Reading Law, at Law Reading on Twitter. You can follow me there. I don't post a lot, and my Substack traffic is probably going to be a bit more muted over the next few months because I'm in the middle of starting my own business. So, right, if you've got any things you want me to discuss, like feel free to either DM me or leave a comment in my Substack. Apart from that, if no one's got any questions, I'm happy to go.
No, what I would say is, obviously do donate, do help us out. Like I said, we'll have some exciting announcements in the near future. Apart from that, no, I would say do watch out for more videos as well. I have some more videos released since I know a lot of you were curious about the Hope Not Hate situation. We're just not trying to comment on that too much, to be fair. That was a bit of a wet fart. And Hope Not Hate appear to have become a smaller organization than our little sphere, with less reach, which is fascinating. It seems that it was people shouting at them more than it was much happening there. And I know a lot of you have messaged me a lot of stuff about the Iran conflict and Trump and stuff, and I will have some spicy opinions on that at some point. But I thought it was just more important to have a very substantive discussion about part of really what can be done, let's say. Because what can be done is very important. I genuinely do think that there are things... I know a lot of people consider us black-pilled, but there are genuinely things that you can do. And understanding the official complaints processes and understanding when to use lawfare is an extremely important little bit of that. I know I've said this a few times, but... And it's great just to have a feeling like you are learning something that you could practically apply to doing something in the political sense. I know that creates a lot of kind of psychic comfort. So despite our black-pilled reputation, no, there is a lot to be done. And as bad as things are, it is possible to pick up a broom. So I'll say thank you again for coming on Match Reading the Law. I'm going to put a little bit of outro music and then we'll go off air. Thanks guys for watching. You'll see a bit more from us in the future, and goodbye.
Bye guys.